Welcome to Forces of Fantasy, a podcast dedicated to all things Warhammer Fantasy and then some. I'm your host, Gert-Jan van Heugde, but since you probably can't pronounce that, I'll just go by my initials, GJ. Today we're going to take a look at the final two books that came with the Warhammer Fantasy First Edition box set. These books are all about characters. There's one book about characters, which has definitely some more role-playing elements in it. Because, as you might know, Warhammer First Edition, although it was a tabletop game, there was still a lot of role-playing elements in there. You could use it for both fighting big tabletop battles as well as for Warhammer roleplay, which later on got its own books and its own game system and is still going strong to this very day. The other book has everything to do with magic. It contains a spells list, it contains how to build a wizard and how you cast spells, of course, the different statistics involved with that. We will take a look at that in a little while, but before we jump into our time machine, I'd like to discuss a little bit of news and hobby. I don't have much news to report, except that the new Lizardmen miniatures are on pre-order now. So, depending of course on when you listen to this, you can go get them in pre-order. I haven't looked at the prices yet, so I don't know how they compare to the other Lizardmen miniatures. Of course, they're not called Lizardmen anymore, they're called Seraphon now, but yeah, I'm still going to call them Lizardmen. I do think if I just pulled up the page here, if I look at these prices, I think they've gone up a little bit compared to what they were. You're now paying €50 for a box of 10 Saurus Warriors, which €5 a piece for a plastic model is quite a lot, especially if you want to get new people into the hobby. And the the Raptodon Chargers, so the Sadus King on feathered gold ones. These are 55 for what appears to be a box of 5, and I think these are also plastic models. So yeah, €11 for a plastic cavalry model. Okay, I might just be a grumpy old guy, but these prices are just rather insane, if you ask me. €35 for a Saurus Astrolith Bearer, which is a single plastic miniature. Just a single sprue with, say, let me count this real quick, 12 pieces, I guess. You get some different options, I think, but yeah, other than that, it's just a single character model. You pay €35 for that, and the new Slan is $67.50. I think this one gives you a few options as well. Well, it's big, it's got that for it. It's for some reason, for scale comparison, they put it next to a Space Marine with a 32mm base and 40mm height from the base to the top. So yeah, that shows you a bit of a scale comparison there, but yeah, I'm not really happy about these prices. And since Games Workshop are planning on releasing the old worlds, I don't know when, there might be another price increase before then. I do have a feeling that they are increasing their prices a bit more often than they were in the past, but that might just be me, or because I have kids and time goes by a lot faster for some reason nowadays, so I'm not sure if that's the case or not. Anyway, if you want new Lizardmen models, they are available, but judging by those prices, I'd say if you don't really care for the make and look and feel of the model, you're probably best off hunting some second-hand sites, because I'm sure some of the older models will come available. Now, as to some personal hobby stuff, I have also been doing things, mainly working on Grease's Goldtooth. I do want to finish him before the end of the month. which, as I'm recording this on the 27th of May, means that I've only got 4 more days to finish it to meet my own deadline, because that's the deadline when the Call of the Crown challenge will end. And then I have to base him and base my Minotaurs, and I've made some good headway there. I still need to do some things like the iron and still some small details, but most of it is done. I'm not quite sure yet what I'm going to do with all the gems, because painting gems with the classic layering technique will take a lot of time and a lot of gems on these miniatures, because one, it's a single miniature, but you've got Grisus, who's got lots of gems on him and on his rings and everything, on the scepter. And then there's also a lot of the Noblars with necklaces with gems on them. So I might just cut some corners there and paint all the gems silver, Mithril silver, and then go with the sort of pre-contrast paint contrasts, which are Soulstone or Spirit Stone. I keep mixing them up, but there's a red one, a blue one, and a green one. The green one is called Waystone Green, and then I believe it's Spirit Stone Red and Soulstone Blue. So these were released before contrast paints. They are made especially for painting gems in this way. These are of the technical range, so the technical paints. And I've used them with I would say great success on my high elves. The gems on Grisus are a little bit bigger, so I'm not sure how that will work. I'm still on the fence about that. I still have a couple of days, so I might do that. And the way that they are painted in the army book does look great as well with the layering technique. So I might just give that a try. Other than that, I've been mostly doing some 3D printing. If you remember from the Wargames Orchard podcast, I have 2 3D printers. I've got a simple resin printer and a simple FDM printer. So the FDM printer, for those of you who don't know anything about 3D printing, that's with a plastic filament that's heated up and squeezed out through a nozzle, and that builds up the model and in layers. It basically prints out a line of plastic and then it builds up on that. And the resin printer, that worked with a little bit of a different principle. It's got a bath with resin, a basin with resin in it, and it's lit underneath with UV light, which cures the resin, and then it hardens it one layer at a time. Now, I've got both of these printers, and I've been running them a little bit, and I'm running into some problems, and cleaning them out, and doing some stuff again. So yeah, the filament printer, that's the one you use for terrain pieces. I've got some lovely terrain pieces here. And the other one I use for miniatures. I'm printing out some Chaos Dwarf miniatures that were free online. I've already printed out some blunderbusses, and now I'm concentrating on hobgoblins, because there is this lovely scenario at the very end of the rulebook for first edition where you have some dwarves being pursued by goblins, and you can also have some hobgoblins in there. I do want to try that scenario out, so I'm going to get me some hobgoblins now, and when I have enough, I'm going to prime and paint some of them, and then I'll just see if I can find an opponent for that scenario, or maybe do a solo play and see if I can maybe get it up on the podcast or on a YouTube channel or on Patreon, or I don't know what I'm going to do with that yet, but that's what's been keeping me busy for these past few days. I've also decided to enter another painting challenge, and this one is going to be hosted in the 4th edition Warhammer Facebook group. So this is going to be an I don't know yet what the rules exactly are going to be, but the
the guy who organizes it, we had some chats about this, and he said that you have to paint a character model the first month, that's going to be your general, and from there on out you're going to have to paint units and war machines and stuff like that. But at every single point you have to make sure your army is completely legal. So that's going to be fun. I've been thinking about doing, well, what I was going to do, and I've settled for dwarves. I've got a lot of dwarf miniatures lying about. And yeah, that's going to be the army I'm going to do next, I guess. I think this challenge will not start until August or something. He's going to let it run from Bring Out Your Lad till the next Bring Out Your Lad next year. So I'm not really sure when these events are going to be held, but I'm sure you can find it. The reason I'm not sure is because I'm not going this year. I have never gone there, but yeah, I do hope that someday I will find the time to go to one of these events, because they do sound like a lot of fun. So yeah, that's going to be it for news and hobby. Now let's jump into a time machine and let's revisit those good old days of 1983. Now please keep in mind that this next part has also been released as part of the War Games Orchard podcast, so there might be some references in there that don't really make sense, and I do apologize for that in advance. We're on our way back to 1983, the year the release of the arcade game Mario Brothers in Japan. It will pave the way for more games in this franchise. But who needs Mario when you've got first edition Warhammer Fantasy? Welcome back everybody to 1983, the year Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay was released. The subtitle of Warhammer, as I mentioned in the previous episode, is The Mass Combat Fantasy Roleplaying Game. Like I said in the introduction, we looked at the Mass Combat section in the previous episode, but we haven't looked yet at the roleplaying aspect. And we're going to do that by taking a look at the final two supplements in this book. Well, they're not supplements, the books in the box. The final two books in the box. Volume 2, Magic, and Volume 3, Characters. And I'm not going through them in the correct order, because Magic is tied in heavily to characters. You first need to create a character before you can have it use magic. So that's why we're going to start by taking a look at characters. The book opens with an introduction about role-playing. Now I'm going to assume that most of you are already familiar with the concept of role-playing. You have a couple of players, you have a GM. The players, they play the game, and the GM, the game's master, he makes a scenario and he plays the monsters and the stuff that the players will face. He will give them the opportunities and the players will have to find their way out and act within the story that the game's master is telling. That's basically what you do in a role-playing game. So there's a little bit of introduction about that. What are the roles for the game's master? Which roles do the players have? And then it opens with player characters. Each player character has three sorts of characteristics. There are the personal characteristics, and the personal characteristics are things like social status, age, sex, intelligence, cool, willpower, and leadership. Then you've also got your fighting characteristics, and these are the things on your profile, the things that we discussed in the last episode. They are in a little bit of a different order than they are in the Tabletop Battles rulebook. They are number of attacks, number of wounds, initiative, weapon skill, and bow skill. your strength grade, toughness, and move. And then the final one is skills. You can have various skills like trapper, sailor, con man, pickpocket. There's even a skill called transvestite, which is probably not very politically correct in these times, but well, we're in 1983 today. You've got, these are rolled on a D100 table. A character's skill will depend upon his previous experience, and like personal characteristics, they should be interpreted by the GM. So, what do you do with these skills? That's basically up to the GM. Then we get to character generation. And character generation is very much role-playing. If you have ever played Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, which I haven't, but I have rolled up a couple of characters using the first edition Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay book, it's very similar to that. So first you start by generating characters. On a 1 to 3 you're a human, on a 4 to 5 you're a dwarf, and on a 6 you're an elf. Then you go to the characteristics, you roll a D100 for the social status, and the higher you get, the higher your level is. So if you're for a human, if you roll a 0 to 50 you're a freeman, 51 to 70 you're a bondsman, 71 to 80 you're a burgher, 81 to 90 is a citizen. Then you got 91 to 95 knight, 96, 97 earl, on 98 you're a duke, and on 99 you're a prince. And dwarves and elves have similar tables, except that dwarves have a much higher chance of being a house serf, and then the next one up is on 80 plus noble, and then you get kinsman, prince, or royal prince. Elves, they have a 90% chance to be a free elf, and in the last 10% you get counselor, elder, or prince. Then you get something about the age. For humans you roll 66 plus 6, for elves it's 10d6 plus 20, and for dwarves, and for elves it's 3d6 plus 20. So dwarves are generally older than elves in this a lot older than elves in this edition. You will start off with one wound. The initiative is for all races d4, humans add 1 and elves add 3. Then you get web skill and bow skill. You roll 2d6 for that, and then you have to decide which of these is your primary fighting skill. Men and dwarves tend to be swordsmen, elves prefer to specialize in the bow, and elves choosing to be bowmen may add +2 to the number that you roll. So you get a number between 1 and 6 depending on what you roll on 2d6. That's a little bit confusing. So if you roll a 2 on your 2d6 score, you've got a web skill or bow skill of 1. If you roll 3 to 4, you got a 2. If you roll 5 to 9, you got a 3. It goes up like that. And then for the secondary fighting skill, you roll a d6 and subtract 2. And that is going to be your secondary fighting skill. So web skill and ballistic skill are determined in this way. In strength, you roll a d6, and depending on what you are, you get 1 or 2 for men and elves, or 2 or 3 for dwarves. Toughness is something similar. You roll a d6, men and elves get B or C, and dwarves get B or C, but dwarves have a higher chance of C, and men and elves have a higher chance of B. Your move rate will be given in the creature list, which is, if I say this by heart, 3.5 for dwarves, 4 for men, and I believe it was 5 for elves or something like that, 4.5 for elves, I believe. So it's in that range somewhere. You roll 1d4 minus 1 to determine the number of skills your character has, and then you roll that D100 table that I mentioned before. If a skill is rolled twice, the GM can assume that the character has a second level in that field. Then you roll for, no, you don't roll for age, but you have levels for maturity. Men are mature at 18 and death is at 60. For elves, it's 24 and 160, and for dwarves, it's 32 and 240. So, yeah, elves definitely don't live as long as dwarves, so that's not very Tolkienian of them. Intelligence, men 1d10, elves 2d6 plus 2, and dwarves 2d4 plus 4. Cool is 2d6, and for dwarves it's minus 2. Willpower, men 1d10, elves 2d6, dwarves 2d6 plus 4. Leadership, all races roll a d6, half the score rounded down. And depending on your status, you can add 1 or 2. Your number of attacks starts off as 1. You get some money depending on your social status level. And yeah, then you are set to go. The next section is about character advancement. So as you roleplay, you gain experience points because you do things. The GM awards them. It's usually for stuff like killing monsters, but also for roleplaying, you can get experience points. For solving puzzles, you get experience points. And depending on how many experience points you get, you can do things with those. You can increase your stats. There's a section here, starts off with a section about what you want to do. If you want to continue as a fighter, or if you want to become a wizard. You need to do that before you start accumulating experience points. And if you want to become a wizard, you have to roll some extra stats. So a wizard will need a constitution, and the constitution is equal to your willpower plus 2d6. You also need a life energy level, and the life energy level is dependent also on a roll. Men get d10 plus 200, and dwarves and elves get 2d6, d10 times 200, and dwarves and elves get 2d6 times 200. And as we will see in the magic section, this is something that can... Basically, your life energy is... You start off with a finite amount of life energy, and when your life energy runs out, you die. Usually, this happens only because of old age, but if you cast spells, life energy can drain faster. So, wizards, on average, live shorter. That's why you need life energy. You also need a wizard mastery level, and your wizard mastery level is 1, but you must have an intelligence of at least 5. You choose one level 1 spell to begin your career, so you're a one-trick pony if you start out as a wizard. Boy, it sounds fun to generate a character in this way. Tell you what, I am going to do exactly that, but not for this podcast episode right here, right now. I will randomly roll a Warhammer Fantasy 1st Edition role-playing character on the Patreon page. So if you wish to hear how that goes, and whether I will be a man, a dwarf, or an elf, and which my social status is going to be, you can listen to it on the Patreon. And this is a good point for me to tell you that our Patreon is non-tiered, so you can join us for as little or as much a month as you like. We're going to put out some bonus content over there, such as this character generator, and I will try to put out some more content there. We haven't always been the best at catering to our patrons, but we do appreciate it, and we do appreciate your continued support for this channel, and we will definitely try to put out some more stuff there, such as this. So if you want more of the Warhammer 1st Edition, apart from the articles and stuff that I'm going to discuss anyway, please take a look at our Patreon page. Our Patreon page is patreon.com/wargamesorchard, or if you just search for Wargames Orchard Patreon, then you can also find us there. Alright, let's get back to the book. After character generation, there is something about experience points. It will tell you what will happen if you are a fighter, for example, and you capture an enemy. You gain double the points for the that you would normally get. If you For each kill, the fighter will receive the number of points equal to the monster's strength grade, and creatures with a toughness of D count as double points, E count as triple points, F count as 5 times as many. Because it only goes to F. A gem may award additional points, and those additional points are things like killing an enemy, hero, or leader. So all of these things get you experience points. Then, if you have accumulated a number of them, you can advance. If you have accumulated 50 experience points, you may advance initiative. If you have 100, you may advance your secondary combat skill. So if you are a fighter, you will probably choose weapon skill. If you are a dwarf or a man, according to the book, so then you have to advance your ballistic skill, your bow skill. Let's see, I'm not sure how this works. I don't think you buy these things. So it's basically you accumulate experience points, and as soon as you reach 50, you get initiative. And as soon as you reach 100, you advance your secondary combat skill. Wizards also, they have an experience table, and that is, for example, Constitution or a new spell or a mastery. And at some point, sometimes also you can choose, it may advance any of the above. Wizards can gain extra experience points through clever and successful use of magic. That's all up to the GM, and there's some penalties. If you cast a spell wrongly, it will cost you 1d6 times 10 experience points. Characters have some maximal levels. They cannot advance any one fighting characteristic indefinitely. There are maximum values given. For example, you can only advance your toughness grade as a dwarf to D and no higher than that. You can only advance your primary skill as an elf to 10 and your secondary skill as well. Initiative level can go up higher to 10 for dwarves, 20 for men, and 24 for elves. And your wounds and attacks can also go up to a certain maximum, which is somewhere between 3 and 6, depending on your race and the stat. Now, what's also important in roleplaying is your alignment. The alignment is, I believe it is role... it's chosen by the player. Player must choose that character's alignment. And the alignments are good, neutral, evil, avarice, and hunger. A good, neutral, and evil you will know if you have played, for example, D&D. But instead of lawful and chaos, and instead of a matrix, you just get two extra alignments here, which are avarice and hunger. And each alignment, depending on what you have, will give you bonuses. Unless, of course, you're neutral. Good aligned characters receive double experience points for slaying evil characters or monsters, and evil characters or monsters receive double the points for slaying good characters or monsters. If you, as a good player, slay a good character, then those are a negative experience, but if you are evil and you kill another evil character, then you don't get any. And evil guys even get treble points for killing or harming their friends and relations. So if you're evil and you need experience points, just stab a party member in the back and you will get over that threshold. Avarice. Avaricious characters receive no extra experience points for acts of courage, bravery, or self-sacrifice. They receive double points for any money they acquire. So, you have to get some money. And hunger. The hunger alignment is common amongst the less intelligent monster types. Hunger-aligned creatures may only have one interest in life, food. Characters with a hunger alignment are rarely encountered, and are usually easily recognizable because of their great obesity. Food-oriented characters receive quadruple bonus for slain opponents that they eat. And the GM should exert his influence to prevent characters acting against their alignment. So good characters should not go around brutally torturing captured opponents, stuff like that. And the GM should always reward extra experience points if the player acts particularly in character. There's a table then on the next page where you can randomly generate the alignment of anything you encounter in the creature or monster list that we saw at the back of the Warhammer Tabletop Battles book, the first volume. Then there's a section about injuries. And this is a little bit more like what you expect from a game of Mordheim and indeed role-playing games. So what happens is that if your full complement of wounds is lost, so if you start out with 3 wounds and you lose 3 wounds, then you're dead. But with long-running campaign adventures, more detail is needed. When the player is killed, roll a d100. Usually the result will be that rather than being killed outright, the player has suffered some form of injury. So for example, if you score between a 1 and a 42, you get a light wound, and anything from a 43 up is a severe wound. Depending on the number you roll, you get, for example, a concussion, a wound on one of your arms, on the leg, or your head, a wound in your eye you can have. You can be out of action for a number of turns ranging from, let's see here, 1 to 20 d6. And the time to recover can be from none to 1 week, 2 weeks permanent. There are some effects. And on the 70 plus, it says here that you will be out of action for 1d6 turns. The time to recover is permanent, and the effect on recovery is dead. So it's basically you're bleeding out. And that there's a risk of death, which is a percentage. Anything between 1 and 69 is from none to increments of 5, it goes up. No, not really. There's 118%. So there's none, 5, 10, 15, 18, 20, 25%, and then you are dead. You can be out of action for a number of turns, which speaks for itself. Time to recover, that's the length of time needed for the injury to heal. That also speaks for itself. The effects, that's what happens with you during this recovery time. And risk of death, this is the percent of chance that occurring during unconsciousness. If you are receiving medical attention, you halve the percentage. So, for example, if you have a pharmacist available. It goes on to an example about Rothnik Mad Hacker Redbeard, a Norman of some repute who has just slaughtered 23 orcs. He has taken 2 wounds. Then he meets another orc and he suffers his last wound, but he's out of action. He rolls a 27 on a d100 score. He's got a light leg injury. He's for 66 or 18 turns unconscious. At the end of the period, you roll another d100 to see if he lives. Rodnick will have to be careful in the meantime in his 2 weeks of recovery. Because if he receives one more wound, he will be out of action again and he will suffer further injuries. Then there's a section about creating adventures. There are some ideas listed, including, which I also mentioned on the unboxing video on the Patreon, rescuing a lovely Italian princess. So apparently Italy in this day and age was still part of the Warhammer world. You get a list like an assassination, capture someone, explore an unknown region or island, and it ends with or anything you like. Harking back to what I said earlier in the podcast, be creative. There are some things here that the GM will have to do. This is your basic role-playing stuff. You get a table with costs. What does a sword cost? You get something about the monetary system. You have a small gold coin weighing a quarter of an ounce. That's a gold piece, a crown, I believe it's called. Yeah, a crown. A shilling is a smaller silver coin, 20 shillings to a gold piece, and a penny is the smallest coin of brass, 12 pennies to a shilling. A And then something about the notation. So it goes C for the number of crowns, and then pennies and shillings are divided by a slash symbol. There are some rates of pay. You can do some actual work other than adventuring. And there are some rates here in a town of about 5,000 people. If you, for example, work as a laborer, you can gain 5 crowns per week, and you get a 30% chance to find work for a duration of 1 to 6 weeks. Then we move on to the encounter charts, and this is just what you expect. There are some, everything here is determined by dice rolls. So when you travel as players, you have to have an order of march. So who's in front? Then the GM will decide the direction of the approach of the encounter. There's a D10 table listed here. And then you get a lot of tables, which are all percentage charts. And depending on where you are, if you are in a marshland or in a coast, you get, for example, if you are walking along a coast, you roll once per day, and if you roll a 0 to 73, there's no encounter. If you roll 74 to 76, you get 2d4 orcs, or you get some harpies, or ogres, or elves, or men. And if you roll 96 or higher, I guess, you encounter one dragon. There's some subterranean tables here. Table 1 and table 2 is there. There are also some things that are, well, this is just the GM's discretion. Oh, it goes on table 3 even. And then it goes on to enchanted objects. These can be magical weapons. These can be named items, stuff like that. There's also a D100 table for that. GM should use their discretion in placing enchanted objects. And then you get the tables for these objects later on, and you get another scenario here, the Red Wake River Valley. This is a role-playing scenario. There are no tabletop battles here as far as I can tell. This is just you need a GM and you need 3 other players. There's a little bit here about the scenario and what you can do, a little bit about the map and the surrounding countryside, what the players should know. And then there is a section, what the players should not know. And that's for the GM, so I'm not going to read this. There are some things here about encounter chances, stuff like that, what's in which specific terrain. There are maps for a tower and for the dungeons beneath the tower. And it ends with the... it ends over here. So, did I say just now that there was also a chart with magic items, with enchanted items there? Because if I did say so, I have been mistaken, because that's all the way back in Volume 2 Magic. Speaking of which, if you have rolled a character, and if you've decided that he is to be a wizard, you need to roll your spells, and you need to know about how this works as a wizard. So, wizards come in 4 different levels. 1, 2, 3, or 4. The title for level 1 wizard is Novice or Initiate, for level 2 is Acolyte, for level 3 is Adept, and for level 4 is Magician or Mage. Keep that in mind next time you face your opponent with a level 1 scroll caddy. These titles, of course, can differ depending on a certain mastery that you may have, or a certain direction that you're going in. Wizards have 3 additional stats that fighters don't have. These are mastery, constitution, and life energy. We talked a little bit about those and how you get those. Constitution, what it does is it basically depends how much magic you can expend before being exhausted and unable to continue. So this is your mana level, to say it in Diablo terms. Life energy, I already explained a little bit about that. You have a large but finite amount, and if you run out of life energy, you die. Casting spells have 6 different characteristics here in this game. Each spells are cast in the magic phase of the active player's turn, And each spell has the characteristics time to prepare, talismans, spell level, energy, time to rest, and remarks. So time to prepare says that the wizard has to remain motionless for a number of turns, and those are the active player turns. So if you have a spell that takes 2 turns to prepare, you cannot move for 2 consecutive turns before you cast it in the magic phase. And if you have a spell that is 1 turn to prepare, I guess you just stay stationary in your movement phase and then cast a spell in the subsequent magic phase. Talismans, these are things like, what I called on the Patreon video, spell focus in Dungeons & Dragons. These are things that you need to cast the spell. For example, you need something personal, a staff or a wand. You need a silver rune ball. You need certain amulets or certain filters, which are potions. You might need a scrying glass or a pure relic. These are all things that you can roll up on the enchanted items table. And if you don't have the item, you basically can't cast the spell. The spells have a level going from 1 to 4. These correspond to the mastery level of the wizards. The higher level spell is harder to learn and to cast. A wizard may not normally learn or use a spell that has a higher level than his mastery level, but there are exceptions if you have a special talisman and charmed objects. Energy is how much the spell costs, and the point is deduced from the wizard's constitution and from your life energy. For a normal game, it's important to know what the constitution is, but in a campaign with a longer game, you have to keep track of the life energy drain as well. And then you get time to rest. This means that after casting the spell, the wizard has to remain motionless in the own player movement phases, just as for time to prepare. But this is just to rest up a little bit from casting the spell. And the sixth characteristic, remarks, this just basically says what the spell does. There's something here about innate magic abilities. Wizards have some abilities which are magical sense. If you as a wizard touch an object which is in some way charmed or affected by magic, you will be able to sense this. There is also the trance of magical awareness. A wizard in the magic phase may enter into a trance. You expend 1 constitution point for each move spent in this state. But if you do so, you can also remain motionless, of course. But if you are in this sense, in this trance, you will be able to sense any magic items being used against him, or any magic used against him, excuse me, so spells also, and a rough direction of all other wizards within 48 inches. And I'm guessing those are 48 table inches. The trance does not inhibit the wizard's ability to move, fight, or perform other magic, but well, if you move, you have to spend constitution points. And then magical attacks. You can try to enhance your own magical attacks. This is basically what you get in 5th edition and 4th edition. You cast a spell, you add power to it, and this also ties in with ability number 4, annihilating attacks, which is what in later editions would be called dispelling. So what you do, if a wizard casts a spell, he can, for example, say, the example given here is Fireball. Fireball costs 2 energy per bolt, but you can increase this to 3 or 4 per bolt if you wish as a wizard. The spell doesn't have more effect, but it will become harder to annihilate. So if you annihilate an enemy wizard, they can spend energy points to counter the spell. And if the number of energy points is equal to half or more the ones used in the attack, then the spell is annihilated and has no effects. So, for example, if I wish to cast a spell with a power of 2, and I decide to increase it to 4, then my enemy has to spend 2 energy points to dispel it. The way you do this in this game is you both write the number of energy points that you wish to expend on a paper, and you hand the papers to the GM, and the GM will say if the spell passes or not. And then there's also something funny, which is the fumble factor. The fumble factor is a chance that a spell fails, I guess more or less catastrophically. What you do is each time a certain situation arises, which is casting a spell of a higher mastery level, or if you are wounded, or if you are attempting to cast a spell that you just learned, then you roll 2d6 before the spell is cast and you apply a modifier. For each wound suffered by the wizard, you add 4. If this is the first time the spell is cast successfully in a real combat situation, you add 4. If the spell is 1 level higher than the wizard mastery level, you add 2. You add 3 if it's 2 levels higher, and 4 if it's 3 levels higher. If the total score is 13 or more, then the spell has gone wrong. The game master must now take over, interpreting the result as outlined below. You roll a d6. On a 1 to 2, the spell affects the wrong person. You have to roll again. On a 1 to 3, it affects the wizard himself. On a 4 to 5, an ally or friend. And on a 6, some other foe. Determined randomly who is hit. If that first d6 roll is a 3, the spell has the opposite effect. So, blessing counts as curse, bloodlust causes the subject to become pliant and passive. That's fun for the GM to interpret what would happen, for example, if you cast a fireball. I guess it will be then ice or water or something like that, a splash of water in your face. The wizard has cast some completely different spell on the roll of 4. If you roll a 1 to 2, it's a spell of a lower level, a 3 to 4 of the same level, and a 5 to 6 of a higher level. And then you have to randomly generate that spell, and on a 5 to 6, the spell has no effect at all. There's a little bit about wizards and characteristics, and it says you have to read the next book for that. But, we just read it, so that's why I read it before that. It goes on to say, a wizard may not normally learn spells with a spell level greater than his mastery level, but occasionally books or talismans will be encountered which offer simple methods of approaching high level spells. So I guess something like reading a spell from a scroll or something like that. I might be completely mistaken here. It might be something that you learn. There is a subsection of wizards which is necromancy, and necromancers, they control undead creatures, but it's a specialized form of wizardry. There are others such as elementalists. It says, to become any kind of specialist wizard, you must first master the fundamental principles of magic. So that means you forfeit the learning of one spell. Usually you when you advance, you can learn one spell at some point. So you don't learn that spell. And thereafter, you may learn spells within the specialty that you've chosen. But you must learn a spell of each level, starting at the lowest. Go on to say here, further supplements to Warhammer will cover specialist magic in detail. So I guess that this is already when they were printing this, they were thinking of Forces of Fantasy, which is the first supplement and the only supplement to first edition. Then we get to the section where you randomly generate spells. You roll a d10 to determine the mastery level. If you have a magical character that you wish to use as a GM, this is not for your player characters. You roll something for the constitution, the speciality, and then the number of spells available, and then you determine the personal fighting characteristics as laid down in book 3. Am I reading this correctly? Let me see here real quick. Let me go back to on that. A particular scenario or encounter may call for a magical character to be used. Or if the character has not been prepared beforehand, then this system can be used to quickly generate such a character. Okay. So yeah, this is not for players, but this is to generate enemy characters, enemy wizards. And then we get to the spells list. Level 1, 2, 3, 4 spells. Those are a D100 table. And then you also get necromancy level 1, 2, 3, and 4 spells, also on a D100 table. These are the spells randomly generated for your non-player characters, because players, they choose the spells they wish to learn. And these spells are not so much the spells that you encounter in later editions of Warhammer Fantasy, at least not the tabletop battles variants, but these are more of the role-playing spells that you encounter in games like Dungeons and Dragons. Now there's a little section about necromancy. Only evil wizards may become necromancers, and the necromancer has the power of summonation and control of the dead. Dealing so closely with death drains wizard life energy, aging and twisting him and reinforcing his evil disposition. Each time a necromancy spell is cast, deducts twice the amount indicated from the wizard's life energy. So your life energy goes down twice as fast. It is a specialty, so you have to forfeit a normal mastery level rise to experience. Then you may learn your first necromancy spell. And then you can proceed to choose either learning normal spells or necromancy spells. And in addition to the magical awareness, they may also act as controllers to units of friendly skeletons and zombies within 12 inches. That's an added bonus to being a necromancer. You can control the undead. Then, after the necromancy spells, you get a list of enchanted objects. These are numbered from 1 to 20, not 1 to 16, I'm sorry. And some of them are subdivided. For example, you get the what they call the talismans, the wizard focus things. They are subdivided, and these are just your magic items. They do things. You got, for example, Niobe's torch, which is a 40-centimeter rod of polished mahogany. If struck against stone, it will magically light and burn indefinitely. It gives us as much light as an ordinary torch. They may only be extinguished by immersion in water, but may be extinguished as and relit indefinitely. You get something like magic weapons, which is subdivided into different, I don't know how many, these are not numbered, but different magical weapons. And some of these magical weapons are basically built your own thing. There's something here like unique magical weapons. Wizards try to produce at least one enchanted weapon sometimes in their lives. And then you get a weapon which is an enchanted weapon, so counts as the full effects against undead gods and demons types. And then you also get things that give you extra attacks or initiative, or less attacks or initiative, or strength, poison, fear, stupidity. Something that flashes brightly when orcs or goblins are near. Going back to Tolkien there. And also some named magic weapons. Yeah, and that's basically the end of this volume 2. There's a 4-inch diameter summoning pentacle in the back that it says you can cut out, but you should probably photocopy, or at least I say you should probably photocopy and not cut into these old relics of Warhammer Fantasy. So with this, we conclude our look at the first edition basic box. It gives us three books with enough information to play the game. In the next episode, we will not immediately dive into the supplement Forces of Fantasy, because between the release of Warhammer Fantasy First Edition and Forces of Fantasy in 1984, there have been a couple of White Dwarf articles that we will look at first. So that's what we're going to do in the next episode, or at least the next episode in this series. There might always be something that comes in between that. And as I had said in the first episode, I'm going to take White Dwarf as my guideline to tell you what has been released in which month. So at a certain point, we are just going to take a look at White Dwarf. And then I'm going to just say, well, in this month, we had these releases and we had these articles, and maybe go a little bit into the articles. It will not be as boring as I present it now, or at least I hope it will not be. So the pace will slow down a little bit over time because a lot of material has been published, but we will try to take a look at anything and everything that has been published about Warhammer Fantasy, or at least the things that I know and can find and can get my hands on. Although I can guarantee you already, I will not have been able to have read everything by the time it is discussed, especially when it comes to the novels, for example. I will not be doing book discussions in this podcast because although I own many of the Warhammer Fantasy novels, I still haven't started reading them. I will also not be doing army book reviews or in-depth rules reviews such as these. I'm basically going to use this as a springboard and then say, well, in second edition we had these changes and these additions and stuff like that. At least that's what I'm planning to do anyway. So with that, I would like to thank you all very much for listening, for sticking around. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I hope you will make your way safely back to 2023 or whatever year it is when you listen to this. And I also hope to see you again next time. Thanks for listening. If you like what you just heard, you can support the podcast by liking and sharing it. You can also get in touch via Facebook. Just look for the Forces of Fantasy podcast community group or for the Forces of Fantasy podcast page, where you can contact me via Messenger with any questions, feedback, suggestions, or requests you might have. If you want to support the podcast and help me produce more content like this, please head over to patreon.com/forcesoffantasy, where you'll also find exclusive bonus content such as unboxing videos and additional episodes.